don't finish school, that really, I mean, just really, you know, they just don't, they're not doing, you know what I'm saying, they don't have anything to, okay, I feel this way. You don't, how do you call it? Okay. You know, okay, I'm not bumming around on the streets, I'm not, you know, I carry myself a certain way, I've taught myself, I never had a model, I never had a mother to say, this is the way you must be. You understand? I never had a model, you know, and I feel that, you know, I think, you know, I have time to improve, but I think that it's, that I've done as good as a lot of these women that have gone out here and gotten an education and considered themselves, you know, on a certain, how do you call it, a certain,
status?
Yes, or whatever, you know. I have been around many people, different, you know, I've been in the company of people that were really, you know, what you would say, very important or very, I have been around very, how do you call it, very important people who never looked down on me, you understand? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've never had a problem with, I don't have problems, I can go anywhere I want to go and not, you know, make myself look stupid or embarrass someone that I'm with. You know, I've never, you know, so far, so I'm pretty, you know, because a lot of people are very ashamed, you know, they become very ashamed and they say, well, she doesn't do anything, you know, what does she do? Well, they kind of keep that quiet, you know, they don't want you to, they kind of protect you or whatever, but I've never had anyone to have to, you know, try to shelter me from someone else's, you know, problem.
I think then what we've heard from both Mary and Dolores is again the question that conflict that arises between degree and non-degree lesbians has very little to do with education per se. It has to do with maybe another kind of category, right, that we have been handed, another kind of measurement we have been handed that does not, in the last analysis, have any real effect, anything really to do with the actual texture, the taste and the tissues of our living. Same way, it has sometimes very little to do with actual education.
It does, very much so.
Thank you, Dolores. Thank you, Mary. The next...
Stay! Janae's going to bring her chair over. We're all going to pass. The next area of cross-cultural conflict that we're going to talk about, Janae Gray is going to talk about ageism, and in particular, the whole question of older lesbians and younger lovers.
Yes, are you comfortable having enough space?
Oh, yes. Within the lesbian community, we have many different combinations of lovers, and each one of us, whether we know it or not, we somewhere in the back of mind, we have a picture of, you know, what we consider is this ideal lover, you know, whether you're straight or gay or lesbian or rectangle or polka dot, you know, you always have this ideal in the back of your mind, you know, through your family, what you've seen, what's happened in your family life, and you've been indoctrinated through our educational system, and before some of you were born, we had nothing but the television, the movies, and everything was sweetness and light in the movies, you know, it was boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, and they get married, live happily ever after, and we thought that this is what we would get too. So when you pick a lover, you know, depending on the type of relationship that you are looking for, and a lot of times we don't even know what makes us pick a particular lover. We don't know whether it's sexual attraction, and sometimes we know that it's only sexual attraction, but we convince ourselves that, okay, we're going to make this relationship work because we want this, and this particular person fills something, a need within us, because whether we admit it or not, we all pick our lovers to fill some particular need that we feel within ourselves and everything like that. And My thing is younger lovers, you know. That's the need that I like filled within me. Before, when I was a younger woman, I always related to older women. And somewhere along the way, I don't know when it changed, I found that my lovers were getting younger and younger. And then I realized that I felt young, I thought young, and outside of the chronological age, everything about me was young, and I just can't understand why people have this problem with an older person and a younger lover. You know, I don't know where it is written in marble or paper or anywhere that says you must be X amount of years older than your lover, or you must be X amount of years younger, or whatever it is. I don't know why we should let a number, because that's all it is. Age is just a number, stand in our way of having relationships. People ask me, why? How can I hold conversation with these young people? I have gone with people as much as 26 years younger than I am, is younger than my son. And people have asked me, what do you have in common? You can't stay in the bed all day. And this is all very well and true, because I have found some people that are older that I couldn't have a conversation with. You understand that, you know, at the end of bed, if it wasn't just for being polite, I would just really ask them to just put on their clothes and leave, you know, because they serve no other purpose. So age really has nothing to do with what you bring into a relationship. If you can sit down and have a conversation, if you enjoy the same things, if you have more than just sex in common, if you enjoy the person and the person enjoys you, then you shouldn't let peer pressure, you shouldn't let anything or anyone sway you from having a relationship with that person, because life, if you live to be a million years old, is still too short. It's not long enough. And there are so many moments of displeasure, of hurt and pain that we suffer in our everyday life, that if we can find a person that gives us any kind of joy, no matter how short the time is, then we should enjoy, we should take it, we should take it with inside of it, we should absorb it like a sponge. So on those blue days, you can think about this precious moment that you've spent with this person, you know? And we shouldn't go into a relationship with the idea that this is the relationship to end all relationships, that it's gonna last forever, because it isn't. When you start out with it really isn't, because if you look at it realistically, if you're 18 years old and you are in a relationship for 10 years, then you're 28 years old. At 28 years old, you're an entirely different person than you were at 18 years old, and the person that you're with should have within 10 years grown in some way, whether they regressed, progressed, or whatever, or stagnated. They should be a different person. And maybe after 10 years of being together, you'll find that what brought you together in the beginning no longer relates to your relationship. So maybe you can have a friendship while you may not be lovers. You know, I have never lost a lover because of another person, but I have ended relationships because over a period of time, 5 years, which is the least I've ever been with a person in a relationship, and 12, which is the longest, we had just absolutely changed our way of thinking. What made us happy together 12 years ago no longer made us happy together now. So rather than sit there and argue and fuss and try to make one another over into what we wanted the other person to be, we severed the relationship, but we retained the friendship. And that's the only thing I want to say about older lesbians and younger lovers. It's a good feeling. When you get a certain age, when you get over 50 and you got a lover over 50, both of you old and tired, the house smells smell the liniment. You know, if they got an ache, you get the ache, you get the pain. Both of y'all don't want to go nowhere. But if you're over 50 and you got a lover that's 25 or 30, she'll say, well, I want to get up and I want to go out and boogie. Well, now you know, if you got this young woman, you are not going to let her go out there and boogie by herself, right? So you get up and you get yourself together, and by the time you're out there for a little while, you no longer need the Sloan's liniment. You no longer have the Excedrin headache number 55. You no longer have the backache or all those kind of things. I want you to take it from somebody who has known through experience. A young lover is the best kind of thing for an older lesbian. You hear me? So when you get to the other side of 50, if you're not in a relationship with somebody that you've been in a long time and you're looking for somebody, I don't mean for you to go around and ask them for the birth certificate or anything like that. But if one of those young women come up, then you think that you can deal with it and your body is able to stand the strain. Take it.
That's come from age and experience. Okay.
I would like to open the floor for the session. I hope you've been using your paper and pencil, jotting down things that you know you want to talk about. I would like to open this out so that we can all talk together, so that you can talk with the panelists on points that they've discussed.
I just have one question, and it refers back to the first discussion on West Indian women. And I was wondering whether any of the panelists have ever traveled down south, because a lot of the things that were brought up in the discussion reminded me of what it's like for black people to live down south. In terms of, well, have you ever?
No.
Well, particularly the points on child rearing, the strictness, how children should not be should be seen but not heard, and how the responsibility of raising the children belongs to the community, and no one thinks nothing of dispensing discipline or encouragement or whatever to anyone's child, because you know it's a part of the community. And also in terms of the language and how people speak, and how there's that kind of flowing rhythmic way of talking where you can spend half an hour describing something, and you never, like, you can ask another person, how are they? But you don't say, how are you? You just go on and on and on, but what you're asking is how the person is. And in answering, the person doesn't say, I'm fine. The person goes on and on and on, and there's that communication, that's happening. And also, I was wondering, it was brought up about how the difference, the contrast between living in an environment where you have that type of relationship with land and being in an urban environment where you're living like 14 floors above the ground and you're constantly exposed to nothing but concrete. And I've been having some very strong feelings about that because I've experienced both things. And I'm beginning to feel that, and I wonder whether any of the panelists, have thought about this, whether it's not your personal struggle, of having experienced the other thing, and it's not only that, it's not only just your personal struggle of having experienced that kind of relationship with the land, and now being, in this urban environment. I'm beginning to feel that actual urban environment is like inhuman, it's anti-human, and that maybe we should start to think about the ways that it affects our psychic, not just the psychic of people who experience the other, the way humans should live, but the psychic of people who've been born and brought up there, whether there's something that's happening there, happening to our minds, when we live around concrete all the time, and when we live 14 floors above the floor, and when we live in these little boxes, what is it doing to our psychic? Maybe it's affecting us in ways that we don't really even know,
Yeah, I agree with you. I have a few relatives that are living on, as Arari described it, a little piece of land. I mean, very, very small little bit of land in St. Thomas. And the last time I was home, I was hearing about the struggles going on there between, there's a whole sort of movement of American business, mm-hmm. men and politicians. Like Rockefeller owns an island in St. Thomas that we cannot step on. That's outrageous. But there's a whole movement there to buy land and to put, the people are put into these projects. Now they think that the projects are nicer because they're pink and blue and yellow. They're very pretty to look at. I mean, they don't look, like the red brick thing. But the fight there, the struggle there, amongst the people who live on a little tiny piece of land. It's a very tenacious sort of fight. And everyone understands that it's not that they are, and my uncle understands that it's not that he is richer right now, that he can grow his pigeon peas and his few little things on his land, but that there's an experience that he has with that. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was growing up in New Jersey, I don't exactly know how, because my grandmother and my family were very poor, but somehow we did live in a house where there was a garden, and we were able to grow things, mostly herbs and pussy. I grew pussy willows, and you know, shit like that. I had a pussy willow tree. And I really do feel that there, for me, being in New York, being cut away from, I can't go and dig, pull weeds or whatever. I do feel a real sort of here, and I think a part of what's happening to me now this year, I'm feeling much more intensely that it's been a long time since I'm home. I'm thinking of it as home, and what I'm really thinking of is going there and touching the ground, you know, having my hands, my fingers in the ground. I agree that there are things that are happening to us.
Whereas people who haven't experienced that feeling of attachment to the land may not know what it is that's affecting them, you know, and I think also we're you know, there's a lot of brainwashing going around. I think we all know that. And specifically when it comes to living in places like, say, New York, you know, where you're convinced into thinking, or, you know, ways that we internalize our impressions so that we start believing that this is where we want to be, you know, and we start believing that, hey, who wants to walk around barefooted out in the field, you know, who wants to work on a farm, you know, you start believing that that your oppression is good, you know, and you don't really, you can't separate what's actually your oppression and what you actually want, you know, and what you've been taught to want and taught to like.
I find it's like a piece of you is missing, you know, once that, I guess it's like people with a habit and they, who don't want to get cured, you know, it's, I got to have it, and, or just people don't understand when you say like, well, Central Park isn't a good example, but if that's the only green in the middle of Manhattan, you're going to make a beeline for it just because of the trees and mm-hmm. the flowers and everything. It's, people might used to call them nature freaks and everything. It's just that it's better for my being to be surrounded by sky and openness and greenery. It just makes me feel better. But every time they put up a building or tear down something, like, you can't grow a tree there. So I don't know. It's just part of me. I think it's necessary.
Another difference.
But that really
as well as the traditional, literary tradition of telling of being great storytellers in speech. But I know that, you know, I felt really an affinity toward that. I felt that similarity. I wanted to ask about a difference, however. In reading, I don't know how many people are familiar with Rosa Guy's Ruby. Aside from the problems I had with the book, one of the things that I loved about it was the way, and I think I read, I don't remember the title of the first book, but it was
Good Friends.
Yeah, Good Friends. That woman, the things that she said to her American, for lack of a better term, lover, the other young woman she was involved in, about, she said, I'm not an American. And I think that's something that I, as a North American woman, have to think about when I'm talking to Caribbean women our political experience is different. Mm-hmm. We don't all, you know, we kind of want to, in an effort to fight against an outside culture that's very impressive, we kind of make a picture of ourselves as a monolith, black people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I remember that this woman said to, that Ruby said to her lover, when she said, I can't hate like you.
Yeah.
I'm not an American. Yeah. Yes, I defer to old, I mean this obnoxious older teacher. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because she's an old person.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is a really important point, because it's also necessary, and again, as I said before, I'm speaking, when I respond to you, I'm speaking in perspective of not of a West Indian woman who was born, not born here, but of a native born, American born West Indian woman, and nonetheless, I grew up knowing there's home. Somewhere there's home. Home is this mythical place, is the West Indies. And someday, if we did, you know, my parents, we were going to go home. That America was just a sojourn, right? That we were not Americans, that this was not our place. And that, you know, dealing with the effects of that in terms of growing up, dealing with that effects in terms of how we view many things, and even overcoming it or using it for advantage, gives a very different picture, I think. I think that also for Gwen and Irori it must, because you have, even in addition, not being born here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when in my family, you touched on a couple of things, but I'm really glad that you brought the point. In my family, that was said all the time, you know, and I, to this day, occasionally I really get a lot of flack for saying that, you know, well, I'm not American. And it's not, I mean, politically, my understanding of, you know, the condition of black people is that we're all Africans, you know, that's that. But on the other hand, there really are distinctions that I feel pressed to make from time to time. For instance, when we talk to each other, one thing that's that comes up very often, I've gone through a lot of struggles with my family, with my mother. And for some reason, my American friend, my friends are mostly women, and I'm talking about black women right now, my American friends always assume that I'm talking about this absolute split. And so when I talk about, relating to my mother or relating to my family, I have to remind them that in West Indian families, it doesn't matter it really does not matter what happens between you when push comes to shove and when it comes to getting down your family. And, you know, as long as you're not about really physically hurting each other, it doesn't matter. And that those splits are not as absolute. And, you know, I get into a lot of things about that. Also the issue of elderly people.
I would just like to address myself to
yes,
Jeanette, because I am a New York born child out of a family from Virginia. I don't think there's a little town in Virginia that you can go to that I don't have family there, including Berkeleyville, Jetersville, Amelia Courthouse, and Cumberland, and Farmville, and you know, everybody wants to say they come from Richmond and Norfolk, even though I have some people that come from there too. But we have an awful lot of little places there. And it's one of the arguments, because I brought it up to Irori in another conversation that we did have, that the Southern American black is very close into their culture of any close-knit culture, including Hispanic. You know, they always say that the black, but it's because they only meet urban.
That's right.
manufactured black, because it's like they put us all in a cookie factory or something and spit us out, you know, to make us accommodate to the environment that we live in, and we adapt ourselves to conditions outside of our home. But I have a son who will be 29 in October, and he is nothing. He was born and raised here in New York, but he is nothing like the average New York child that you will ever meet. And people that who know my son can tell you that he is a perfect gentleman. He is a polite young man, because he was brought up in this southern environment where if someone was older than you, you didn't disagree with them verbally, no matter what you thought. You kept it to yourself. You didn't even roll your eyes. You didn't suck your lip. You didn't turn your head, because this just wasn't done. And this is one of the things that I think a program like this is very helpful, because we live our lives thinking that we are all so different, and we're not really all different. It's only that we are put into this environment, and in order to survive into this environment, we seem to take all the negative aspects. We allow the people that oppress us to almost whitewash us and wring out of us everything that is our heritage, that we, from our family. We no longer want to live with our family. When I was coming up, it was not unusual, and before my grandmother died, it was four generations there in the same building. We did not all live in the same apartment, but we all lived in the same building, because we lived in the urban area, and we did not own a home, but we were all there. Now, it seems to be as fast as you can. You move away from your mother, you go to another borough, you go to another state, you go to another country, you know, so that you no longer have these family ties. And like Gwendolyn said, we too, you know, in the nitty gritty, you know, even if your child murdered somebody, you know, listen, I always tell anybody, anything that my child did, he's got to have a reason. He just didn't do it. You know, there's nothing that nobody can come tell me that he did. He had to have a reason. You know, you just do not forsake your family. You do not forget your friends and people that you were raised with. You just don't leave them out there in the lurch. You know that there's always somebody that you can go to.
I want to make a meaningful contribution. And I've listened to what you just said about cross-cultural differences, and then analogizing the Caribbean experience with the Southern Black individual. I grew up in the Midwest, and I guess one of the things that I have to say, or one of the things that I've observed, is all of us sitting in this room who are Black were raised by mothers and fathers who, at one point in time, probably traversed south of the Mason-Dixie line. We didn't all get born in Manhattan, all right? And you mentioned growing up in an environment where, you know, something was said to you, you didn't like it, you didn't roll your eyes because for fear of being slack. And I cannot imagine, I may be wrong, but I cannot imagine that any of us here in this room that grew up under Black parentage would have taken the liberty to roll your eyes at anybody and say anything for fear that you're going to lose your life.
That's right.
And we may have become, if you will, so worldly or so sophisticated that we forget from whence we come. But I think that all of us basically come from the same place. And there may be differences, but don't think that we really need to sit back and touch again from whence we come and understand where we are today. And we can probably even appreciate the differences a lot more than we do now.
I have a question that is not directly related to the program, but I'm the lady who touched upon it beyond our panel discussion, and that is lesbians as mothers, and I'm a mother also, and I've heard many people on the panel speak about their children, and I wanted to know, in terms of lesbians who have older children, my son is very young, 4, how do you relate to your children, how do your children relate to you, and in terms of you being a lesbian?
Well, Janesh, I have no problem. It was never discussed in my family. It was always understood
if I look like a card carrying member of Jimmy Hoffa's union, I was still the mama. And he was the child. My son, we have very good rapport. To give an example, going back some years, because I come out of an entirely different lesbian background than a lot of the younger women here. I come out of that very solid butch role-playing background. And some years ago, I was having a wedding and getting married to this young woman. And my son came home unexpectedly from the airport. And that didn't bother me or anything like that. The night that my friend gave me a bachelor party, my son took my intended bride out so she would not be in the house by herself while I was out having a good time. And I was the one that, as the wedding drew nearer and nearer, because I was getting married at home, I just went to him and I told him, I said, well, you know, we're all right and everything like that, but you just cannot be at this wedding, you know. And he told me, he says, well, what I'll do is I'll answer the door and have the people sign their names in their in the guest book. And the friends of mine that have children, I have always found that if you respect, I think there's something that a lot of time we lose for one another and we don't give to our children. I find personally that I respect my child as a person. I imagine he must respect me too, because we have that kind of relationship. If you respect the other person and demand respect of them, then you can live your life as you desire, because you cannot live your life for your children, because your children will grow up and leave you, and they will leave whatever kind of life that they want to live. And no mother, or no father for that matter, should go through life sacrificing everything that they want to do in life for their children, so when the child is grown and the parent has nothing, all they can sit back and have resentment for what they have sacrificed for this child that has gone on and is living their own life. I think that you should give as much as you can to the other person. You must realize that we're all individuals, and I don't think that it would be so many problems with mothers and fathers with their children if they just would understand that children are just little people, but they're people. They have feelings, they have thoughts, they have ideas, and above all, they want respect. And if you respect them as little people, you will have no problems respecting them as they get to be larger people. And you can't like or love a person, really, that you have no respect for.
I think I would like to underline most of the things that Janae has said. I have two children, two teenagers, one a boy who's 15 and a half and a girl who's 17. And I would say from the time that they were 2 or 3 years old, it was very clear, I felt that it was necessary to make very clear to them that I was a lesbian, what that meant in terms of opposition from outside. But also, again, raising black children in this country is raising them to be warriors to begin with. And getting across to them that, A, when people put you down, when they chase you in the streets, they will find some reason, whether you're black, whether your parents are lesbians, whether you don't dress right, whatever, right? And that to be able to recognize who they are, recognize who we are, and to have it open was very, very necessary. Things of that kind are only used as weapons against children when they are unsure within themselves how they deal. And of course, when you deal that way with a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 5-year-old in school and so forth, it's scary. I must say that I feel now at this point, where they're 15 and a half and 17, really that the rewards are being reaped, that they are very, very tough kids and that they're very clear-sighted. I also would like to say that what Janae says, I feel very, very strongly also that the strongest thing that we can give our children is a knowledge
that we, as women, are ourselves. That sacrifice is not, nobody's buying sacrifice. Sacrifice is not what it's about. Because invariably, you pay and your children pay. You know? That they grow up, they go away, they lead their lives. If you have invested yourself in that child as opposed to in your living and your loving of that child, then you will be asking from that individual something you have no right to ask anyone, from anyone except yourself.
I'd like to say a couple of things in response to your question. My daughter is 8, and I'm raising her very different from, in certain ways, very different from how I was raised. I was raised in a much more rigid kind of situation where my grandmother, for instance, didn't kiss little children. You know, she sort of, beyond a certain age, you know, you stop kissing them because they'll get too familiar and they'll expect, you know, certain things. And I'm sort of moving away from that sort of, you know, child-rearing atmosphere. I'm trying to raise Francesca to be very independent and very strong and very free. Now, that has a lot of problems because other people don't expect that. And other people try to put on me responsibilities for things that she does that are not my responsibility, and that's very, very difficult. But as Janae and Audrey said, I, in the back of my mind, keep the idea that, you know, she is a person all in and of herself. I am out to her, and she does understand what it means to be a lesbian, so that makes it a little bit easier as far as I'm concerned.
The real problem, I would say, most of the problem being a lesbian mother has come up within the lesbian community, not between me and my children. You know, has been somehow a real reluctance to understand, for instance, when they were younger, some of the real demands, you know, of just the physical attributes, physical and financial demands that having children means. You know, that there's some things that you can't do. A, you may have a full-time job, but when the kids, you know, teeth and sickness and everything, A, you don't have money to put into, you know, some threads that you wanted to. That kind of thing. Or bringing them, you know, bringing the kids around. And there being a real process, and in particular with my boy, right? I think that as women of color, as black women, we have to recognize very early that the position of, and I speak again for myself, but I think that it's wider, the position of man-hating or total rejection of men is not something, is not a luxury that we can indulge in. And I am always saying that one of the things that my son does is help to keep me honest, to recognize that that kind of simplistic explanation of oppression doesn't go down, does not function for us. You had your hand up. You forgot your question.
Oh, I got off the point. I'll come back to this. It's back to the cross cultural conflict. And, well, first I'll just echo what a lot of you said. I grew up in the South, and I recognize the similarities in behavior and patterns of you know, parenting and extended family and so forth, similarities in the Southern tradition and the Caribbean, which also extends. It really isn't just the Southern tradition. It's really the black tradition, given a certain cutoff in terms of generation, because we are beginning to see something very different with new urban generations. But, and so those things are really very clear in terms of the similarity. But the point that you were making earlier, Grant, that it's important to make the distinction between who we are as Afro-Americans and Caribbean-American women, because that distinction is based on historical reality that has brought us to this dialogue tonight. So while there is a lot that we can see when we start going under it that's similar, so forth, there are still those conflicts that have been created. And I think it seems basically they come out of what the slave experience was like and what the post-slave experience is like, which we're still in. And that has dictated to some degree the survival mechanisms that we've set up, the values that we've been able to hold on to, let's say Caribbean, where you really see in diaspora that you still keep the language flowing in certain kinds of ways, the interactions flowing in certain kinds of ways. And so there's been certain kind of psychic, economic, historical space which has caused us to develop very differently. And we see that manifested in our individual religion. And that, it seems to me that what this forum is about is, you know, keeping us unnoticed and encouraging us in the process of really going, you know, making a leap across that gap, because there is a real gap, there's a real chasm that's been created by historical reality. And I guess it was at the point that we were really getting into, you know, how similar
and closer that I was wanting to interject this point.
In agreement with that, and I don't want to start it, but we don't have the historical reality also has to deal with English-speaking Black Caribbean women and Spanish-speaking Black Caribbean women.
French-speaking Black Caribbean women.
Well, not increasingly so. Increasingly so. What's happening with Haitian women and the difference within the Haitian lesbian community? With are there any representatives here? No. Very large and very very strong and becoming stronger. Good, Anita.
I want to ask Aurora if there are many lesbians in
Island,
and how do you get together?
Okay, I can speak from when I was there. I went on a visit previously since then in 72, and it was more open. Before, there were no clubs. I mean, there are a few now, but they're male-oriented, like certain parts of Puerto Rico where they have a gay section of the beach and everything like that. What it is that women used to meet, like say how they had those quilting bees when all the women got together, or cooking parties, or, you know, a lot of female-oriented things. That's where you would find the women that would eventually be your lovers. Or sometimes in families, cousins were thrown together. I mean, everybody was related. I heard you were saying that you'd be amazed how many cousins you could find on an island. And that way you had less supervision because I'm going over to the cousin's house, you know, and you can account for sleeping in the bed because, like, people were very, it was large families too, and that also gave nobody looking any different at two or three women, young ladies in the bed. I didn't know. I wouldn't know what the old lesbians were doing. We only knew what the younger ones were doing because it seems that they...
Most of the older ones are doing the same thing. Only four of them. Exactly the same thing, but more of it.
So, and school beaches, and like when you went... to market, getting together in the marketplace and stuff like they still have some open marketplaces and all sorts of meeting places. However, I would say that it wasn't necessarily secluded to lesbians because an uncle of mine, which is the black sheep of the family, he started the whole thing, he was gay and he was ostracized and he moved to New York, and what I found out is that only the people that were speaking to him, I didn't know at the time, but they were the gay members of the family. Nobody else was speaking to him, and it didn't occur to me that, you know, he was like a liaison. They would all go over to his house and have parties. Now, since it's become a tourist attraction and everything, people have bungalows separate. There's places. St. Croix is much quieter than St. Thomas. If you want to party, everybody goes to St. Thomas because they got the most nightclubs and everything. Well, there's a certain travel bureaus are now doing it. They're just getting a bunch of lesbians, go on a schooner, I think like the Windjammer and stuff, and they get down there. They sail down to the West Indies and they just take over a certain part of the island. And what it is now, they're not getting a lot of flack as much as they used to because I see a t-shirt that sister's wearing, we're everywhere. It's now a thing of people, I didn't realize, I guess they were just there, but they weren't that open about it. Now, the younger they are, it's amazing, like the gay youth that they have here. People just coming out in high school, college, even married women, some of them are divorcing, which is unheard of, let's say my mother's time. You'd stick with that guy no matter how much hell he gave you. Divorce was just not a thing that anybody did. But now I know of an example where she divorced her husband and went with her lover. So it's that kind of thing. Like, yeah. It's like Gwen was saying, as long as you're not physical and they see that you really mean it, they're not going to bother you. You can relatively be safe from, let's say, physical abuse, like how I heard that some people used to actually attack you because you were gay at one point. But I think it's gotten more open with the times.
I understand from my mother that when I finally told her, you know, through the whole progression, I finally told her I was a lesbian. I understand from her that what was done in her day and in my grandmother's day was that the women did it on the side, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was sort of understood that women had, my mother had her friend or whoever, you know, they had their friends. You had your husband, and your husband was out doing whatever. There's an incredible double standard in St. Thomas, and all the islands, incredible double standard. So you might see a family where, you know, the man has this family here and this set of children and this family here, and they all know each other, their own family, and the woman's on the side doing her thing.
Mm-hmm. As we have always been done. Okay, we have time for one more question or comment, and then we're going to break. Anyone else now? Yes, Virginia.
He was very young, of course, when I became gay. So now he's grown up in the back.